Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo and Jonathan Evans, as well as the American history series, Making of a Nation. But first, this report. College student Grace DeNoia is used to people laughing when they learn what she is studying. Her degree centers on the marijuana plant, an intoxicating drug that is illegal in many parts of the world. I say, no, it's a serious degree, a chemistry degree first and foremost. It's hard work. Organic chemistry is a bear, the 27-year-old told the Associated Press. DeNoia is one of the first students in a new 4-year degree program in medicinal plant chemistry at Northern Michigan University in Marquette, Michigan. The school, known as NMU, is one of an increasing number of colleges and universities that are preparing graduates for careers growing, researching, and selling the plants. Schools are answering changes related to the legalization of marijuana in the United States. It is legal for medical purposes in 33 states and for non-medical use in 10. Lawmakers in other states are considering making marijuana legal. At the same time, industries supporting legal marijuana are expanding across North America. As a result, research shows the future is bright for all kinds of careers in cannabis. The family of plants that includes marijuana and its non-drug relative, hemp. Jobs include growers and store operators, and even producers of cannabis-based foods. People can also work as sales specialists, laboratory directors, and pharmaceutical researchers.
ArcView Market Research reports on the cannabis industry. The organization estimates the industry will support 467,000 jobs by 2022. Brandon Canfield is a chemistry professor at NMU, where Grace DeNoia goes to school. 2 years ago, he proposed a new degree program in medicinal plant chemistry. The idea came after he attended a cannabis industry conference. There, industry representatives spoke of an urgent need for chemists to produce quality tests for cannabis products. "We're providing a fast track to get into the industry," said Canfield. NMU's 4-year degree is the closest thing to a degree in marijuana at an accredited university in the United States. It has drawn nearly 300 students from 48 states, Canfield said. Students will not grow marijuana, which Michigan voters only recently legalized for non-medical use. But Canfield said students will learn to measure and produce medicinal substances from plants such as St. John's wort and ginseng. They can then use that knowledge with marijuana. A similar program is being launched at Minot State University in North Dakota this spring. The college said students will learn laboratory skills related to medical marijuana.
NMU professor Brandon Canfield noted that students who study marijuana could find jobs paying $70,000 right out of school. Those wishing to start their own businesses can add classes in accounting, legal issues, and marketing. "I came in planning to maybe go work in a laboratory," said Grace DeNoia. She noted she was first considering nursing school when she heard about the NMU program. "I just switched to the entrepreneurial track. I figured that would better position me, as the industry is still expanding and changing and growing so much." Colleges are creating many different offerings to answer the expected growth in cannabis-related jobs. Colorado State University offers a cannabis studies program centering on social, legal, political, and health effects. Ohio State University, Harvard, the University of Denver, and Vanderbilt University offer classes on marijuana policy and law. The University of California, Los Angeles has launched a cannabis research initiative. The school claims it is one of the first academic programs in the world centering on the study of cannabis. Researchers there are currently looking at issues such as medical treatments and economic effects. Agricultural schools are also getting in on the action. The University of Connecticut is launching a cannabis growing program this spring. Jennifer Gilbert Jenkins is an assistant professor at the State University of New York in Morrisville. The Central New York School is launching a new program in cannabis studies this year. Students work with hemp and other plants rather than marijuana. But they can do internships at medical marijuana companies, Jenkins said.
Colton Welch is an agriculture business student going through Morrisville's cannabis program. He points out how many uses the plant has. "I see a lot more farmers reaching out and trying to find people who know about this new crop," he said. Carson Humiston is the head of VANGST, an employment agency specializing in cannabis jobs. She said the future looks good for students in this area. "More jobs are being created in this space than in any other space in North America, with salaries sometimes more competitive than other industries," Humiston said. "With every new state that legalizes, tons of jobs are opening up." I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Now, the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. Today, we talk about a color found all throughout nature, green. Green is also very common in American English. Let's hear Warren Shear read a story about these colorful expressions.
Green is an important color in nature. It is the color of grass and the leaves on trees. It is also the color of most growing plants. Sometimes the word green means young, fresh, and growing. Sometimes it describes something that is not yet ripe or finished. For example, a greenhorn is someone who has no experience, who is new to a situation. In the 15th century, a greenhorn was a young cow or ox whose horns had not yet developed. A century or so later, a greenhorn was a soldier who had not yet had any experience in battle. By the 18th century, a greenhorn had the meaning it has today. A person who is new in a job. About 100 years ago, greenhorn was a popular expression in the American West. Old-timers used it to describe a man who had just arrived from one of the big cities back east. The greenhorn lacked the skills he would need to live in the hard, rough country. Someone who has the ability to grow plants well is said to have a green thumb. The expression comes from the early 1900s. A person with a green thumb seems to have a magic touch that makes plants grow quickly and well. You might say that the woman next door has a green thumb if her garden continues to grow long after your plants have died. The Green Revolution is the name given some years ago to the development of new kinds of rice and other grains. The new plants produced much larger crops. The Green Revolution was the result of hard work by agricultural scientists who had green thumbs. Green is also the color used to describe the powerful emotion jealousy. The green-eyed monster is not a frightening creature from outer space. It is an expression used about 400 years ago by British writer William Shakespeare in his play Othello. It describes the unpleasant feeling a person has when someone has something he wants. A young man may suffer from the green-eyed monster if his girlfriend begins going out with someone else. Or that green-eyed monster may affect your friend if you get a pay raise and she does not. In most places in the world, a green light is a sign to move ahead. A green light on a traffic signal means your car can continue on. In everyday speech, a green light means approval to continue with a project. We want you to know we have a green light to continue this series next week.
Give me the green light. Give me just one night.
And that's the end of this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
Health experts are concerned about Ebola virus disease spreading in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo. Eastern Congo is currently facing the second deadliest Ebola outbreak in history. More than 600 people have already died from the disease since last August. Hundreds more are infected. But a recent study found that one out of four people questioned in Eastern Congo last year do not believe the Ebola virus is real. Nearly half said they thought some people were making up the Ebola outbreak in order to gain money or power. Their beliefs are strengthened by the economic and political insecurity in the area. The study was published in the Lancet Infectious Diseases Journal. It was based on interviews done last September, about a month after the outbreak was first reported. Researchers say the study showed how people's misguided ideas about Ebola were making it harder to fight the virus. Ebola is spread through body fluids, so stopping the virus depends on isolating those who are infected. They must be separated from the rest of the population. But those who did not believe Ebola is real were far less likely to seek help at a treatment center. They were also less likely to agree to an Ebola vaccine. Eva Erlach is with the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. The group has more than 800 trained volunteers working to tell people in Eastern Congo how they can prevent the disease. Erlach called the findings absolutely interesting, even if the interviews were done more than 6 months ago. She said they showed the connection between trust and preventive measures. Tariq Rebel of the International Rescue Committee is currently working in Eastern Congo. He said the findings confirm what he and other workers are seeing. As the virus spreads, helping communities take steps to prevent the disease is almost as important as treatment, he said. Rebel added, "It doesn't matter if you have all the treatment options available because no one is ever arriving to take advantage of that." I'm Jonathan Evans.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Morris Joyce and Frank Oliver continue the story of the man who served as America's 22nd and 24th president, Grover Cleveland.
Grover Cleveland began his second presidency in 1893. His two terms were separated by the presidency of Benjamin Harrison. Cleveland took office again just as the United States was entering an economic depression. Businesses failed. Banks closed their doors. Workers lost their jobs. And farmers lost their farms. President Cleveland believed the depression was caused by the government's money policy. At that time, both gold and silver were used to support the value of the American dollar. In Europe, however, only gold was used. American investors and bankers were afraid their money would drop in value because of the use of silver. They began exchanging their money for gold. President Cleveland wanted to return to the gold standard, too. To do this, he had to urge Congress to kill a law which forced the government to buy silver. Before Congress began its debate, the president discovered a cancer in his mouth. The cancer needed to be removed immediately, but the operation had to be kept secret. News that the president's life was in danger could have an effect on the debate. It could make the nation's economic crisis worse.
So, the operation was done on a private boat in New York Harbor. Doctors removed some of President Cleveland's teeth and much of his upper left jaw. Then they removed the cancer. The operation took only a half hour. After a few weeks, doctors made Cleveland a new jaw out of hard rubber. He wore it without difficulty. A newspaper printed a story about the operation, but administration officials denied it. The facts did not become public for many years.
When President Cleveland returned to Washington, he sent a message to members of Congress. He urged them to kill the law which forced the government to buy silver. He noted how people throughout the nation had been exchanging their paper money and silver for gold. He said he was afraid the Federal Treasury would soon run out of gold. Then it would have only silver to support the dollar. If that happened, he said, the United States no longer could claim to be a major nation. President Cleveland said, the people of the United States have a right to a money recognized as such on every exchange and in every market of the world. Their government has no right to injure them by financial experiments that are opposed to the policies of other nations.
After the president's message was read, the House of Representatives began its debate. A young congressman from Nebraska spoke in opposition to the president's position. His part in the debate made him famous throughout the nation. His name was William Jennings Bryan. Bryan said the United States should continue to make and use both gold and silver money. Using only gold, he said, increased the value of the dollar, and that made life difficult for America's farmers and workers. They had to pay more to borrow money, and for farmers, a more valuable dollar meant lower prices for crops. Bryan described the situation this way. On one side of the debate stand the business interests of the United States. On the other side stand the unnumbered masses. Work-worn and covered with dust, they make their appeal. But too often, their cry for help has sounded hopelessly against the outer walls, while others, less deserving, find easy entrance to the halls of Congress. The president is wrong to act on the demand of the business interests. He can no more judge the wishes of the great mass of our people by the words of these middlemen than he can measure the ocean's silent depths by the foam upon its waves.
No other congressman spoke as well as William Jennings Bryan. Yet his words could not save the silver purchase law. The House of Representatives approved President Cleveland's proposal to kill the law. The Senate did too. The United States was firmly on the gold standard. Everyone, especially President Cleveland, waited for the economy to improve. It did not.
More businesses failed. More workers lost their jobs. Tens of thousands of men left their homes to look for work. Some of these men began to unite in protest groups they called industrial armies. One industrial army was organized by a man named Jacob Coxey. Coxey proposed that the federal government should hire unemployed men to build roads. He said the government could borrow enough money to pay each man $1.50 a day. Coxey decided to take his proposal to Washington. He also decided to take his industrial army with him.
Coxey's army marched many kilometers from Ohio to Washington. Hundreds of unemployed men joined in along the way. But by the time the army reached the Capitol, only 300 men remained. City officials barred Coxey's army from meeting on public property. They barred them from asking people for food or money. Jacob Coxey was ready for the worst. He said, if my men starve in the streets of Washington, the smell of their bodies will force Congress to act. Coxey tried to read a protest statement at the Capitol building. Police stopped him. The protesters then pushed forward in what police later called a riot. Several of the men, including Coxey, were arrested. A judge found Coxey guilty of violating public property. He sent him to jail for 20 days. Without Coxey's leadership, his army broke up. Its members went home. Yet, the economic and social pressures which created Coxey's army did not ease. Protests and strikes continued throughout the nation.
The biggest strike started in Chicago against the Pullman Company, which made railroad cars. The man who owned the company, George Pullman, also owned the town where his workers lived. He owned the stores, the houses, the schools, and the library. When the economic depression began in 1893, George Pullman cut the size of his workforce. Those still working received less pay, yet Pullman did not reduce the cost of rent for his houses. Anyone who protested lost his job.
In the spring of 1894, a labor union organizer went to George Pullman's town. He was Eugene Debs, leader of the American Railway Union. Pullman did not want his workers to belong to a union, but he did not stop them at first. More than 4,000 workers joined. Immediately, the new union members voted to go on strike against the Pullman Company. Other members of the union supported them. They agreed not to work on trains that included Pullman cars. Within a few days, 60,000 railway workers were on strike. 20 railroads were closed down. Union leader Eugene Debs attempted to keep the strike peaceful, but he could not control strikers all over the country. So railroad companies asked the federal government for troops to break the strike.
The request involved a legal point. America's Constitution says federal troops cannot be sent to a state unless the state government asks for them. And no state government had asked for them. President Cleveland met with his cabinet to discuss the railroad company's request. They finally agreed to send federal troops to Chicago, where the strike had started, to enforce federal postal laws. The troops would protect trains carrying mail. The arrival of the troops led to more violence. Eugene Debs and other leaders of the American Railway Union were arrested. The Pullman strike ended.
President Cleveland faced increasing political problems. Organized labor denounced him for using federal troops to break up the Pullman strike. Farmers and Westerners attacked him for opposing the use of silver money. And everyone blamed him for not doing more to end the Depression. These political problems would have a great effect on the next presidential election.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.